Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. After much anxiety, social justice and climate activists were mostly heartened by the midterm election results 2 weeks ago. Now, what are the next steps we must take to ensure that a progressive agenda moves forward in Oregon and across the country? Today, we're going to do an election retrospective with Eric DePlace, Sightline Institute's program director, as well as a forecast for the upcoming legislative sessions in Oregon and Washington. We'll also check in on what's happening with fossil fuel fights around the Northwest. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, and we have quite a dense table of contents to go through today.
I think so.
But let's start with, I'd just like to know your response to the elections. I mean, we've been going around, I guess all of us have been going around talking about it for the last couple of weeks, but what was your response?
Well, I think my response was like most other folks on the progressive side of the aisle. I was heartened to see the results. It's nice to that the Democrats have retaken the House at the national level. That certainly opens up some windows for progress on climate and other environmental issues. Probably slows down the rapaciousness of the Trump administration a little bit. And we had a good outing in Washington as well from a climate perspective. So that was nice. I mean, there was in Washington one big loss, and that was the defeat of Initiative 1631, which was about an initiative that would have put a price on carbon and then used the revenue to fund a variety of sort of climate adaptation and clean energy measures. So that went down, but apart from that, I think it was a really good night for those of us in the Northwest.
Actually, I was a little disappointed by something else. Actually, there are two other things in Washington that disappointed me. One is closer to me than it is to you, which was the congressional district that's in Clark County and goes up,
sure.
I guess, through Cowlitz County. And Carolyn Long, it seemed like she had a pretty good shot against Jamie Herrero Butler, but didn't win. And I sort of scratched my head about that because I thought it seems like there's so many changes demographically and in other ways happening, particularly in Clark County, that I was surprised that Butler was able to hold on to her seat for another 2 years. And then the other one that I was very disconcerted by, Oregon and Washington had kind of twin initiatives that were nominally called anti-sales tax on food initiatives, which were actually initiatives that would prohibit being able to impose soda taxes, among other things, and probably any other tax on these mega food corporations. A lot of Walmart was part of it, Kroger, Safeway, and I guess a lot of the soda pop companies. In Oregon, it went down resoundingly, and it was going to be a constitutional amendment, which maybe is part of the reason it went down. In Washington, I understand it passed kind of resoundingly, and I kind of wanted to parse what's the difference between Washington and Oregon on that particular issue.
Yeah, that's a darn good question, and I wish I had a crisp answer for you, but you're right that in Washington, the ballot initiative passed overwhelmingly, and just as you say, so it was Seattle and some other local jurisdictions have passed taxes on sugary beverages, the big sort of giant food lobby fought back, and they fought back with a huge amount of money and a very effective marketing campaign during the ballot initiative season. So they were I think in Washington it was say no to grocery taxes, and they kind of portrayed the initiative as a way to prevent government from taxing regular food, which is, so in Washington, we don't have a sales tax. We do have a sales tax, and it's about 10% in places like Seattle, but it does not apply to food. It does not apply to groceries. And so the lobby, the grocery lobby, the big food lobby, the agribusiness lobby, sort of build this as, well, government's going to start taxing your regular groceries, not just your sweetened beverages like, Coke and Pepsi and Gatorade and what else. My sense is that my guess, and I don't have empirical research to back this up, but my sense is that the difference maybe is that this long-standing exemption on grocery food in Washington is important to voters, and they were afraid of losing that exemption. I don't know why it would be so different in Oregon, I guess. But
we don't have a sales tax. I mean, that's one of the differences, that Oregon has never had a sales tax. I think in my lifetime here as an Oregonian, which is a good part of my life now, it's I think there's been three efforts to put a sales tax on the ballot. It's always gone down like 3-1. And actually, the last time it went on, I, who am a diehard opponent of sales taxes, actually voted for it because the funding for our schools in the state was so tenuous, and it seemed to be the only answer. So my friends who were teachers were saying, vote yes on it. But it went down to my pleasure, actually. But one of the things that, when I first heard about the tax, and like there was a petitioner, I don't know if at the farmer's market or someplace early in the spring, and they had this thing, no sales tax, where, you know, this is an initiative to stop any sales tax on groceries. And my response first was, well, we have no sales tax on groceries, and most places that have sales tax don't tax groceries. Well, it's coming, and this is going to prevent it from happening. So I kind of, without thinking, signed the thing. And then he handed me another petition, and I looked at the next petition, which I don't remember what it was, but it was like, oh no, I should not have signed this petition. So I felt it was like part of my duty for the rest of the year to like really let everybody know about this really nasty sales tax. But I was concerned about the initiative because I thought people would really fall for it in Oregon. And so I was still scratching my head about what the difference is, and maybe it is that the fact that you have a sales tax, people are afraid that the food exemption could at some point be removed.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. I mean, there is Washington. I mean, Oregon's tax system isn't. I mean, frankly, it's not great, but it's not anywhere near as bad as Washington's. And I think there's a lot of consternation, kind of across the political spectrum, about how bad our tax system is. So for those folks who may be listening and don't know this. When economists or others will analyze state tax systems, Washington's is the most aggressive in the nation, and it's the most aggressive by a long shot. I think Florida is number two, but we're quite a bit worse than Florida.
And why is it so regressive? I mean, there's a key thing there, but let's talk about what's that elephant in the room about why your tax system is so unfair.
Yeah, so the federal government has a progressive or graduated income tax, which is largely progressive, so that means if you are relatively low income, you pay a smaller percentage of your income in taxes than you do if you're higher income. If you're wealthy, you have a good income stream. You pay a higher percentage of your income in taxes. In Washington, it's the exact opposite of that because we are heavily reliant on sales taxes. So if you make a purchase in Seattle, I think it's 10.1% is on top of the purchase you make, and then we have a sort of property taxes. We have no income taxes, and we have a very peculiar business and occupation tax. It's also a really stupid tax for a bunch of reasons I won't go into right now. But so suffice it to say, if you are very sales tax heavy, sales taxes land disproportionately on lower income people because the lower income people tend to spend pretty much all of their paycheck buying necessities. Where that's not true for upper-income people who invest or save a lot of their money or spend it elsewhere. And so as a consequence, if you're poor in Washington, you spend a greater percentage of your income on taxes than a higher-income person. And the difference is actually kind of a lot. As a consequence, although there's a better social safety net in Washington than some other states, particularly in the East, Washington is a terrible state to be poor in from a tax policy perspective. And because our Constitution restricts our tax authority, almost everything we consider in terms of raising revenue for state necessities like schools and roads and everything else tends to also be regressive. And so in this state, we're really stuck in a box. Like Oregon, every 10 or 20 years or so, we consider changing our tax system. We put an income tax on the ballot about 10 years ago now, and it just got annihilated at the polls. And it happens over and over again.
I think I'm just thinking a little bit about the mentality difference between a state where a sales tax is an anathema and a state where an income tax
right.
is an anathema. Because, I mean, in a lot of ways, Washington and Oregon don't see themselves as being that different.
Mm-hmm. But I think they're not in most ways, yeah.
But I actually thought in this election that some real stark differences showed up.
Yep.
And this was one of them. So I want to go back to Initiative 1631, and just do a little bit of a postmortem on that. I was very excited by it and thought it was definitely going to pass. And then I was up in Redmond and Tacoma a week before Election Day, and I saw so many no on 1631 signs that it made me think, this is not going to pass. Because I saw it in places that I didn't expect to see it, actually, those kind of signs. And it wasn't just the ones that are stuck in the roadway by people, but it was just in front of businesses and people's homes and things like that. So I'm wondering what happened besides the fact that $33 million was poured into the opposition campaign by the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess before I proceed too far, I will mention that this ballot initiative was the most expensive race in state history by a long shot. So I think progressives ultimately ended up putting about $15 million into trying to pass the thing. But for every dollar that they spent, it was matched 2-to-1 by the oil industry. And the opposition funding was, and it's not an exaggeration to say, you know, 99.9% or something oil industry. So they came in like something out of Star Wars and just, completely blanketed the state with negative advertising on social media, on television, with flyers, with signs. Like, it was pretty astonishing to watch. So I don't think we can discount the fact that they basically opened up what are essentially unlimited coffers and dumped it on Washington because they don't want it to spread. So that is an important factor. But I think if you kind of zoom out from that and look at the structural dynamics of what it takes to pass an initiative like that, it's an uphill battle from a couple of different points of view. We went back, Sightline went back, and we reviewed every ballot initiative over the last, 20 or 30 years in Washington. And you'll not be surprised to learn that if you are proposing to levy a fee or a tax on something, you're likely to lose. And if you are proposing a yes campaign, you're likely to lose. So it's always easier to persuade voters that it's too confusing and to vote no, and it's always easy to persuade voters not to spend money on something. So trying to swim upstream against both of those currents is a challenge. It's been a challenge historically in Washington. This was a big movement. It was a credible movement. They ran an excellent campaign. They did a lot of momentum building, a lot of movement building. But, given the kind of tilted playing field plus all the oil money, it just wasn't enough at the end of the day.
Well, I had Nick Abraham on, your former colleague for Sightline,
who's
the communications director for the campaign. And I had him on, I guess, the beginning of October. And I actually felt, when I was talking to him, I felt a little disconcerted. I brought up the failed GMO labeling campaign in Washington a few years ago, which seemed to follow a similar trajectory and had a similar being outspent by the food conglomerates, kind of the same people that were passing the anti-soda tax initiative.
Right.
And I just had this feeling from the answers he gave me that somehow I wasn't getting enough concrete ideas about, how are you really going to counter what you know is coming? Because I think that they knew what was coming. I didn't feel like there was any naivete at all, as opposed to the GMO campaign, where I thought that the GMO labeling campaign really didn't know what they were going to be up against. But maybe, I just wonder, this any way that you can figure out a strategy besides raising as much money as these people raise to, and maybe it's what you have to do, I don't know, but that there should be some way to counter this. Or the other way is to go back and do it at the legislative level, which is what I hear people are talking about now, but that also hasn't worked in Washington or in Oregon so far.
Well, right. So, I think if you look around the whole world, I think it's roughly a quarter or a third of the world's economies are, like, economic activity is operates under a carbon price. So carbon price is not exactly, at this point, a newfangled or untested thing, but they've never been passed at the ballot. Well, it's been defended at the ballot once in California as part of a larger sort of defense of clean energy policies generally, but it's never been passed at the ballot anywhere in the world. And so probably the better strategy at this point is to go into a legislative body and work out the details there, where you at least have an institution that's somewhat capable of dealing with complexity and trade-offs, which you don't really get to have that conversation in a ballot initiative campaign. You present voters with a binary choice. The opposition screams bloody murder, or we'll often do this thing of like, we agree in principle, but not on the details, and that's frequently why no votes are so strong or no campaigns are so strong. That being said, it is tough. I mean, it's always valuable to do a postmortem and to figure out sort of what we could do differently next time. This one, I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of folks are looking at the arc of the campaign, the spending, the strategies, and wondering, what could have gone differently. I don't have a complete set of answers about that. I do know it was an awfully broad movement on the yes side. And so it's sort of disheartening to see it get beat, and get beat, frankly, pretty decisively. I mean, it wasn't like this was a close call for voters. So probably a lot to learn there still, but I would suspect that, you know, one of the lessons, and I think you're right to point out the GMO campaign, which was at the time, I think, the biggest spending from a no campaign ever. There's real danger in the ballot initiative process. Oregon and Washington both have very permissive provisions in their state constitution for ballot initiatives, and it is a little worrisome to think that big corporations can come in and start to kind of screw with public policy at the ballot. So there's definitely a cautionary flag there, I think. Now, I have a longer answer to this, but I don't know if we have time to get into it now. I actually think we need to start thinking more about reforms to our voting systems and our democratic processes. And Sightline has this whole program on democracy reform. We're working in British Columbia, or very closely monitoring, a proportional representation ballot initiative in British Columbia. We think that will be interesting to watch. I think Oregon and Washington, if they adopted something like that, would be definitely get better representation in the state legislatures. They'd also probably get better policy.
And we saw the great lesson from Maine this year about it.
That's right. Yeah. They've got a ranked ballot, which is a step in the right direction toward reforming this, you know, bizarre sort of single-member districting system that we use in most of the United States. That really is very uncommon in democracies globally.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're doing an election retrospective with Eric DePlace, who's Sightline Institute's Programs Director. And we'll also be forecasting in the few moments about some of the upcoming legislative session activity. And we'll also at some point give an update on what's happening with fossil fuel struggles around the region, which are definitely, they're definitely heating up. Well, on the other side of having climate change initiatives on the ballot, well, first of all, one of the things that was pointed out across the country on every media I've heard is that there were three primary climate change initiatives on the ballot, 1631 being one. There was one that's trying to control and limit fracking in Colorado, and then there's another one that's dropping. I'm not remembering what the third one was, but it was somewhere, in the Southwest. And all three failed. But I was watching Bill Maher on Friday night, and Van Jones did point out that there was, on the city level, a climate change initiative that passed resoundingly, and that was Portland's Clean Energy Fund, which is going to go into effect next year. And I was just wanting to do a moment of why this worked on a city level and the difference between trying to do these kinds of fees and climate change initiatives on a city or county level as opposed to doing it on a state level.
Yeah, well, David Roberts at Vox, I don't know if you read him, but he did a pretty good roundup for those clean energy initiatives. The third one
couldn't remember.
we're talking about it was a renewable energy mandate in Arizona that would have been largely favorable to the solar industry. Anyway, so that one, the one in Colorado that was trying to constrain fracking and drilling, and then the carbon fee initiative in Washington all went down. But you're right. Portland passed this initiative, and my suspicion is that it's got a lot to do with the composition of a progressive urban area as opposed to the composition of the whole state. Probably, if it were legal in Washington, I suspect it's not legal, but we could probably pass something like that at this level of Seattle or King County. I don't know what would happen if 1631 were to run in Oregon in the same way that it would run in Washington. There's a different – Washington has an oil industry in a way that Oregon doesn't. But, my suspicion – so the thing in – I can't remember the exact name. What was it called in Portland?
It's the Portland Clean Energy Fund. Called the Portland Clean Energy Initiative.
Gotcha. Right. So that's what I thought. Okay. I keep switching those around in my head. But not a complete solution to climate change, but certainly a good step in the right direction and positive momentum. Lots to like about it. I think the vote was pretty clear, right? I mean, the voters came in pretty
solidly. 2-1. Yeah.
It'd be fun to see if we can replicate more success like that and then begin to there's an argument, I think, for doing a bunch of these at more local jurisdictions in a way that are pretty carefully tailored to those local jurisdictions until there's a big enough sort of patchwork that maybe then you can go after the entire state. So Certainly deserves a round of applause. I'm pleased to see the results on that.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is there are a lot of similarities between Portland's Clean Energy Initiative and 1631. The biggest difference I saw was that the Clean Energy Initiative was actually driven by communities of color. And it was led by groups, several groups that represent different aspects of the communities of color in the Portland area. And it was actually a lot of support and help devised by our now city councilwoman-elect Joanne Hardesty, who's been an interesting intersectional character for years in Portland between dealing with black community and dealing with racism and also really being very involved in environmental issues. So I think she's going to be a very... Of course, and there's a little bit of a disclosure. She's been a KBOO programmer for a really long time. But she took a break. She took a break while she was campaigning, obviously, but she'll be back here, I guess, and after the first of the year. Okay. And so there's some hope there. But I think that was actually a significant difference because I think there was a little bit more trust on the part of people. When I was actually going around and doing some canvassing, and I did talk to some people who were concerned about, well, how do we know the money's going to go to serve low-income people and not put solar panels on all these expensive apartment buildings that are being built? And I said, well, it's in the fund. And there's always this thing because I guess the way you write these initiatives, you can't specify as clearly as the opponents will try to make you specify where the money's going. But I'd say that people who voted for this can rest assured that the money's going to go where it was supposed to go. And that was another complaint, I think, about 1631. People didn't really believe the money was going to go where they said it was going to go.
Yeah, and the industry, I mean, so when the industry started doing message testing about what were the weak points to the voters for 1631, that was definitely one of them. But it's interesting. I think you raised a really interesting point. So 1631 actually did have very strong support among communities of color. In fact, a lot of the foundational elements of that came out of a group called Front and Centered, which is a sort of a constellation of people of color-led groups that are focused on environmental protections in Washington. The final ballot initiative language included a lot of input from the tribes. Now, the ultimate group that backed the initiative was much, much bigger than Front and Centered in the tribes, but it included those voices early and in a very prominent way. One of the features that came out of that was a method for dispersing the revenue that was supposed to really honor the needs. Both the participatory needs, but also the sort of actual structural monetary needs of those communities. The way that was written into the ballot language allowed the opposition campaign to exploit kind of all this uncertainty and say, well, this is going to go to these sort of unelected commissions and these bodies that we can't control, and who knows what's going to happen to the money, and it's going to get funneled to labor, or it's going to get funneled to, you know, and that was all kind of, they were blowing smoke, of course. But it turned out to be an effective message with the voters who were concerned that there wasn't enough oversight on those commissions. But I think the campaign really does deserve credit for bringing in community of color-led groups in a really early and important way to kind of build up the fabric of that initiative. Had it been, you know, it passed in three counties. So, you know, if it had been running at the King County level, you know, it's roughly 1.8 million people, you know, would have supported that thing, and that would have been pretty cool. Tragically, you know, they were trying to make the case to the entire state, and that just wasn't enough.
Well, I'm sort of trying to visualize as a kind of role models for this kind of initiative working its way out from liberal urban centers to the rest of our largely rural states. Thinking about the plastic bag ban, which I guess Seattle's had one for a long time, Portland's had one for a long time. Portland, I think, was the first city, though it might not have been. It might have actually been either Corvallis or Ashland, but it was one of those three liberal strongholds in the state. And now the plastic bag ban is definitely spreading into other communities across the state. Interestingly, not into Clackamas County, which is just like a half a mile from where I live. If I go to the Fred Meyers in Oak Grove, they give me plastic bags still. But I think that there are models of how ideas that start in cities can filter and percolate into rural areas and be able, by demonstration of how they're working in the cities, that some of the, there's enough similarity. There are some similarities between urban communities and rural communities where they can see that they have shared values. And I think climate change could be one of those that could be recognized.
Yeah, and I think you can do things with the renewable energy standards for a utility, for example. So you could have an urban area, or the utility that represents an urban area. You can have, if you've got public ownership of it, you can begin to create renewable portfolio standards for that utility, and on the strength of the success of that utility meeting those standards, then you can bring that argument to a larger venue. I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting is, so both Oregon and Washington have vote-by-mail systems, which are wonderful systems. I don't exactly know the history in Oregon as well, but in Washington, historically, we could vote by mail, but you had to put your own stamp on the thing to mail it in. And so King County, which is it's not the most progressive county in the state, but it's by far it's a very progressive county. It's much bigger than any other county. King County then said, okay, well, for our voters, because counties control, their local elections, we're going to pay the postage for all the ballots in King County. And as soon as the other counties heard that, they freaked out, because what would have happened, of course, is it would have increased representation from King County in statewide votes and proportionally diminished it in other counties. And so very quickly, all the other counties came on board and started paying for postage for their own constituents as well. So that was a big net win for the entire state's democracy, but it was an example of a locality sort of leading the way and saying, "Well, we're going to do this first," and then it becomes clear that the incentive is for everybody else to join along, and that could very well happen in a place like Portland, where you've got this big kind of economic driver for a lot of the state. If they're the first mover, could be that that what happens as a consequence is that everyone else wants to get on board that train once it's moving.
No, just as an aside, Oregon's had vote by mail since 1996, and we still have to put our own stamps on the envelopes. So we haven't gotten that far. But I think that one of the things that I noticed, and I particularly pick this up when I do canvassing, I think at least in Portland, the majority of people drop their ballots at the library or any of the many drop boxes around the city, and they're pretty available throughout the state. So it may be that we don't really have a vote by mail system; we have a vote by Dropbox system.
And Sure, right.
It's like a 3-week or almost 4-week early voting system. After watching all those lines at the polls in Florida and Georgia and New York, and I think even in California, it makes me really appreciate our vote by mail.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some of those places are clearly pretty broken in terms of sort of bread and butter issues of voting access. It's really alarming to see, and especially in contrast to how easy vote by mail is both to participate in and to administer. So it's clearly a better system what the Northwest has got going on. Alaska's joined that system or is about to join that system, which is cool to see. It's kind of spreading from the Northwest out.
But I think California,
Oregon, I think, was the first leader on that.
Right. Well, we actually, I remember it was the when Ron Wyden ran for Senate for the disgraced Bob Packwood seat, and that was the first statewide vote by mail. We've been doing vote by mail for little initiatives for tax levies and things like that for off-season elections, and that started sometime in the early 90s, I guess. But the official statewide started in 96, and that was the first election, and I think the next probably was in 98 for the next midterm election. It became... That was it. You had to vote by mail. And there was a lot of, I wasn't a big fan of it when it started, because you have this, romance about going to the ballot,
sure,
to the polling place and stuff. But I certainly have really begun to appreciate it. Probably it took me a couple of years and I really got it. Well, people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about the elections and kind of what went well and what could be improved in this past midterm election. And now we're going to look a little bit ahead at Eric's projections for the next legislative session. So Eric, let's pronosticate here for a little bit. What do you see are going to be the crucial issues that are coming up? Let's first do the Washington legislature, and then we'll do Oregon.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I hate to make any predictions at all without first invoking Yogi Berra, who said that predictions are hard, especially about the future. People are wrong so often that I'm always reluctant to dig into this. I will confine myself mostly to environmental issues, since I study those more closely than others.
And this is an environmental show. Should we stick to environmental?
So I'm not entirely off base.
That's right.
We will see... we will see some movement in the Washington legislature. I think it's a big question mark still about whether Governor Inslee and the backers of Initiative 1631 want to come forward with a carbon price or a carbon fee of some kind. That's still on the table right at this point. I don't know how that shakes out. They're clearly going to have to go through a vote counting exercise right at the beginning. And frankly, there will be a lot of swing districts where 1631 went down pretty badly. So they'll need to have a compelling argument to those legislators about why a carbon fee that they propose in the legislature would be preferable to their constituents compared to what they saw at the ballot. That'll be a challenge. But the composition of the legislature got more Democratic in both houses in Washington. Governor Inslee has a pretty strong hand right now. So, I expect to see some progressive legislation come through. We might see something that, whether or not a carbon price comes through, we will see a serious look at moving toward a 100% clean energy electricity grid in this state. We already have a pretty clean grid, but we've still got some coal and some gas, coal imported by wire. Some gas produced locally and some other gas imported. I think there's a strong move now to phase all that out over the next couple of decades. Take a look.
I just want to inject, because this term, coal by wire, I think some people don't know what that means. So what does it mean that it's imported by wire?
Yeah, thank you for bringing me back up to reality. So coal by wire means, so in Washington, there's a big utility in western Washington called Puget Sound Energy. Puget Sound Energy is partial owner of a very large coal plant in eastern Montana. So they run that coal plant, and then the electricity that it generates gets shipped by wire into western Washington utility customers. So that's when we say coal by wire, that's what we mean. So what we'd like to do is have PSE end that relationship and transition away from using coal-fired power to using only clean energy sources, and we think that can be the case for every utility in the state, and in not that long a time horizon. We think it's a doable proposition, so that will be on the table. And then also, one thing I'm particularly interested in, which is having the state legislature begin to require reporting and regulation of leaks from natural gas infrastructure. So natural gas is primarily methane. It travels all along pipelines and other distribution systems, and it leaks all along the way, and that leakage is a pretty big contributor to climate change. And we don't know as much about it as we should, and so we'd like to begin turning the screws on the industry and going after them and forcing them to report and comply with better standards on that stuff.
Now, is that something that can happen on the state level as opposed to the federal level?
It can happen on the state level, yes. There are limits, and we're still exploring exactly what those limits are, but the state does have the ability to regulate pipelines to a degree, and so we're still trying to figure out exactly what the contours of that are. But we also think that we know that we can require the companies to assess and report what that information is, and we know that we can require state regulators to calculate the reasonable impacts of those emissions. The industry can be required to let state officials assess and regulate their infrastructure, or at least assess the infrastructure, even if not force them to do as much stuff as the feds can.
Now, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a recollection that under the Obama administration, there was starting to be a tightening up of regulating or accounting for the leakage and trying to regulate the leakage of gas pipelines, and that Trump has undone all that.
I think undone a lot of it. Yeah, I don't know if every component has been undone, but the Trump administration, not surprisingly, has very much sort of backed off and taken this very light hand on the gas industry, which is unfortunate because it's a potentially very big climate problem. It could, depending on who you believe, natural gas infrastructure could be as bad as coal from a climate perspective. So we need a lot more attention to what that industry is doing and how it's expanding.
Now, however, according to the supplemental environmental impact statement for Tacoma LNG, the gas that they say that all the gas is coming from British Columbia, and they have a less than 0.1% leakage rate. So do you think that British Columbia has figured out some magical way of doing it?
Sorry, I just totally interrupted you, because that supplemental EIS there is a disaster. It is riddled with bad assumptions and bad faith calculations. That's one of them.
Actually, we're going to get to that in a little while.
Yep, sorry.
We'll do that after the next quarter hour. So, because that's a big piece, I think, of what we're looking forward to. But sticking to the legislative agenda, actually, I just got a note from a listener that Oregon State Senator Michael Dembrow, who's a Democrat from Portland, is backing legislation to have the state prepay for ballot postage. So, see, after all these years, Oregon's going to catch up with Washington on that one. So, back to methane leakage. So you think that Washington State could do its part in really reducing the leakage from all the gas pipes around the state?
We think so. Yeah, we think that there's a lot that the state can do. It probably starts with getting the industry to assess it and to report on it, and having state officials begin to understand what that leakage is like and begin to include that calculations in their review processes. That's probably the first chapter of a longer story, but the gas industry is, of the fossil fuel industry, I mean, if you've got coal and oil and gas is the one that's really set to potentially expand quite a lot. It's also less well understood than the others. And so for those two reasons, it probably needs more attention than coal or oil at this point. I'm quite worried about the ability for that industry to expand rapidly and bring with it kind of this climate Trojan horse of a disaster with methane leakage. So I'd like to spend a lot of attention on that in the near future.
One other thing that strikes me as a big issue in Washington State right now is the very dire status of the orcas in Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there any legislation about, I mean, a lot of the issue actually, well, it's actually... it's in Washington State. There's those four Snake River dams that are in eastern Washington, which are contributing to a lot of the loss of salmon in the Columbia River, which eventually would make their way up to Puget Sound and be eaten by orcas. So I'm just wondering, I know there's been a lot of pressure in Governor Inslee to take a stand on this. I'm wondering if anything might happen legislatively about that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised at all if we saw legislation in this session about that. I mean, the southern resident orcas, as they're called, there are northern residents, that is, orcas who stick around kind of in the BC-Alaska region. Our southern residents stick around Puget Sound most of the time, and they're transient orcas that come in and out. But they are iconic. They are absolutely critical to the state's identity, and they are hugely important to the governor and to many, many people all across the political spectrum. They are not doing well. They're, I think, 70-some still remaining, and they're aging. They're having a big problem with sort of infant and juvenile mortality when those whales are born. And there are a lot of contributing factors to what's going on. There's persistent stormwater pollution. There may be some impacts from whale watching and other vessel traffic that create a lot of noise for them. But the big one, as you mentioned, is probably pretty basic, and it's food. They eat salmon. Transient orcas will often eat marine mammals as well, but the southern residents do not. They're fish eaters. And so the salmon stocks have been really beat up all over the Northwest. Puget Sound is no exception. And there's very good reason to believe that the Chinook run that was badly damaged by the four Snake River dams is a key component of their kind of food portfolio that was knocked out a while ago. So bringing those back... would be a really big deal. But at the same time, we need to bring back salmon all over the place, too, because it's not the only fish that they eat. The Snake River Dam issue is a really interesting one to watch develop. I don't know exactly how that's going to sort out, but certainly I think there's more interest in it now than I've seen in quite some time.
It's interesting, because I've been following that since I started working on river issues and salmon issues back in the turn of the century. So it's been like 17, 18 years I've been working on this issue, and the Snake River dams have been like the big boogeyman ever since.
Yep.
And so many times they look like they're going to be removed or at least breached. I think actually the preferred method is to breach them rather than to remove them.
That's right.
And it still hasn't happened. And even under Obama, 8 years of Obama, we couldn't get rid of those dams.
Yep. And they sort of serve two functions. They contribute a little bit of higher hydropower to the region's grid, and they provide lockage so that you're getting a little bit of barge traffic on the river. But increasingly, it looks like there's not much need for either one of those purposes, and they're extremely expensive to maintain. So the return on investment, just from an economic perspective, looks increasingly like they don't make a lot of sense.
Well,
so,
yeah, back in 2002, actually, when I was doing this documentary about Columbia River, and I got a ride on a tugboat, and I wanted to go all the way up to Lewiston. And I was told by the tugboat company that, well, we don't have very many boats that go up to Lewiston. So they all basically stop at the McNary Dam, and we'll take you from the Bonneville Dam to the Dalles Dam, which is what my ride was. So that was the sense I got. Well, really, the barge traffic was minimal. The electricity generation is like 10% maybe of our electricity or less came from those dams.
Well, I think it's like 4%.
And then they did some irrigation. That was it. So it was clear that even back in 2002, they were useless. I wanted to talk a little bit also about the Oregon legislative session. I'm not sure how up you are on what's going on there, but do you have any idea of what we might expect to see happen in the next season?
Yeah, well, I think the one that I'm most interested in Oregon coming up would be the potential for Oregon to kind of join forces with California. California has a big clean energy system. It involves a carbon price as well as a lot of other things. And it looks like with Kate Brown being reelected, there's a very good chance that Oregon will move forward with that, probably with at least nominal buy-in from the utilities and the big industrial customers and everybody else. And I don't know exactly all the details, but there's a pretty well-designed, some pretty well-designed ideas about how that might work. So we'll be looking for the governor's office to initiate that process and to introduce legislation probably early in the session or before the session starts, and kind of cautiously optimistic that will succeed.
Because we've tried that twice in the last two sessions. nothing has moved. I mean, the Democratic majority in the Oregon's legislature just grew some more. I mean, it's a super, super majority now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no excuse except that there seems to be some reason why these things don't move. But do you think that Kate Brown maybe will have more leadership in this than she's had in the past? Or
I
offer
think
more
so.
Leadership?
I think with stronger majorities, I think in both houses, and with her reelection, she's in a really good position to do this, and she's, I think, signaled pretty strongly that it's important to her. I think it's what she wants to be her signature issue. So I'm, I don't want to overstate it, but I'm cautiously optimistic that Oregon will be able to do that. And then I one of the reasons I want that to happen, I mean, it's good for the climate, but is that it makes clear that Washington has become the laggard on this issue. Or California has had a system in place for a long time. BC has a different system in place. If Oregon passes it, that will leave us out in the cold, and hopefully that will create some incentive for us to finally take action here as well.
Well, I remember a couple of years ago, Oregon was saying the same thing about Washington, because it looked like Washington was going to pass it, and then we were going to be the only hole in the green wall.
Right.
Well, we'll do our best here.
Yeah, good.
I mean, actually, let's just talk a moment about what changes you see not happening, perhaps, because Kate Brown was reelected. Because we got really nervous about the possibility, because I guess Phil Knight poured in about $2.5 million to Newt Buehler's campaign. So what impact do you think Kate Brown's reelection is going to have on the environment and the climate in Oregon?
Well, I think it'll be, overwhelmingly positive relative to what else could have happened. There are still some, I think this piece of legislation I just mentioned is probably the most important part of that. I think the interesting question to me is whether or not the governor's office and the legislature or anybody else can really start to wrap their arms around big fossil fuel export projects. And in particular, I'm thinking of the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas project in Kitties Bay. That is a huge project with tremendous potential to wreak havoc on the climate, not to mention on local landowners and the forests and waterways and everything else of Southern Oregon. And it really hasn't gotten anywhere near the attention it deserves from statewide advocacy groups, from elected officials, from anybody. And that's been somewhat frustrating to observe. It's not certainly not the only time something like that has happened in the Northwest, but it would be really nice to see the governor's office take a strong stand on that issue and say, this is a climate bomb and we shouldn't allow this to be built in the state of Oregon. Whether that will happen, I don't know.
Well, we're hopeful. Well, let you know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking about what what happened in the elections, the midterm elections a couple weeks ago, and also the legislative outlook for the next year in Oregon and Washington. My guest is Eric DePlace, who's the programs director for Sightline Institute. And now, Eric, you just segued into the last topic, which is the fossil fuel fight here in the Northwest. And I'm glad you started with Jordan Cove in Coos Bay. Last spring, there was a big rally in the Capitol in Salem calling on Governor Brown to take a stand and basically pull the plug on Jordan Cove. And at that time, there was one legislator in Oregon who had come out strongly against Jordan Cove. I don't remember who she was, but she was great, and she was at the rally. And shortly after that, I had an opportunity to interview my own state rep here on the show about, when she was talking about clean energy programs and all these great things that were going on. And I asked her about Jordan Cove, and she kind of sidestepped it and didn't really want to talk about it. I found out recently that she's come out strongly against Jordan Cove now, too. And I'm wondering if you have any sense of a growing move amongst legislators in Oregon to take a stand against Jordan Cove.
Yeah, I mean that's my sense. I haven't done a count, but I mean my sense is that kind of one by one, and it's slow, but folks are moving that direction. I mean, I should say thank you for getting her, you know, up on stage or on the air, and then asking her that question in a serious way, because that's what legislators need to hear, you know, from their constituents, but especially from members of the media. You know, this is not something that's just wrong with Oregon. This is wrong in Washington too. Is that it's been way too easy for elected officials to sidestep taking a position on stuff like this, and it's peculiar to me. I don't quite understand it, but it's a really bad deal. Because something like Jordan Cove, that could be the most significant impact, single impact that Oregon has on the global environment. So it's all fine and dandy to do a bunch of other cool stuff, and Oregon's doing lots of cool stuff. No shade on that, but you can't also let Jordan Cove get built, or it wipes out, you know, the kind of net effect of the progress. And so, you know, I think, you know, trying to hold Governor Brown accountable, trying to hold every state legislator and every agency head accountable for that decision is the right thing to do. Oregon has a lot of authority over that project, and it's not okay to just sort of throw up your hands and say, well, it's an import-export issue, it's trade, blah, blah, blah. That's not fair, and it's not how the climate works.
And actually, it's interesting to watch. Some things were starting to move in the right direction on the state level, as they moved in the absolutely wrong direction on the federal level when Trump basically reinstated the whole thing. And FERC, I guess, I'm not sure if they've actually decided again, but it seems like the project, of course, after looking like it was dead, is up and running. Its proposed state is up and running again. But it seems that the Department of Environmental Quality has pretty much held fast that Jordan Cove has to follow through all the protocols and go through all the steps, and they can't skip over ones like they wanted to. So that gives me a little bit of hope that maybe even if the process is just allowed to work its way through the state level, that it won't be in the favor of Jordan Cove.
Yeah, I mean, I share that belief. I mean, I think that's right. And there are lots of ways in which big projects like this run afoul of at least state values and probably state law, and probably, you know, when they're required to do full permitting review, you know, it turns out there are lots and lots of problems with them. You know, the other part of me, the more cynical part of me, is like, well, sure, of course they should have to do the full permitting review, and it's so frustrating that these projects will propose these bizarre fast track situations, and then we debate whether or not we should fast track them. Like, no, the answer is absolutely. I mean, my answer is no, it shouldn't be built at all, full stop, ever. But we should at least require them to do all of the analysis and review that any other large project would be required to do.
I'm going to be going
ranting about this for a while. Sorry, Barbara.
Well, actually, I'm going to be going down there in a couple months, because this documentary I'm doing about frack gas in the Northwest is going to be looking at Jordan Cove as well, which is the granddaddy of frack gas projects in the Northwest. So we'll be doing a lot more on the show, because I'm developing some good contacts besides the usual suspects. So listeners can stay tuned, and I'm hoping to be doing a couple shows in Jordan Cove towards the end of December. I want to move to.
I'm looking forward to hearing those.
Yeah, well, they'll be there. And I find one little thing. I find it interesting that years ago, when Jordan Cove was proposed and a bazillion LNG, first they were going to be import terminals, then they turned into export terminals, just like Jordan Cove, over in, around Astoria were proposed. Portlanders got really on board in fighting the Astoria LNG facilities, but nobody got really involved in Jordan Cove. And now in the last 9 months, there's such a groundswell of energy of people in the northern part of the state really taking an interest in what's going on in the southwest corner of Oregon that it's very heartening to me, and I'm going to do my part as well to really keep people aware of what's happening there. But now I want to move a little closer to home, and let's go to Kalama.
Yeah.
Because there's
some
stuff that's starting to happen there.
Yeah, so I think I like what you just said, that Jordan Cove is the granddaddy of fracked gas projects in the Northwest. That's right. The second biggest one is this project at Kalama, which is, I guess, about, 45 minutes north of Portland.
Yeah.
Little community on the Columbia River on the Washington side. And at Kalama, there is a giant proposal to build a giant petrochemical refinery. So it would take large quantities of fracked gas and convert it into methanol. So it's taking methane and turning it into methanol, gas to liquid. And so methanol is it's a liquid, like I said, it's a liquid petrochemical. It would then be shipped to China, and in China it would be used either to make plastics or to fuel vehicles. No matter how you slice it, it's a pretty raw deal for the climate. It's not what the project backers are claiming, but they're either mistaken or lying. That community has been having a big, big fight over whether or not to permit this big new petrochemical project there. If it gets built, the project backers have said that they want to build a companion project on the Oregon side of the river at Port Westward near Clatskanie. So the thinking from the advocacy perspective has been to stop the one that's on the books in Washington and prevent the Oregon one from getting off the ground, because my suspicion is that the Oregon one comes directly hard on the heels of the Washington one if they can finally get that thing through permitting.
And actually, the Oregon one could be killed by land use laws, and that's what's going on right now. The Columbia River Keeper and a couple other groups have filed a suit with the Land Use Board of Appeals for the Oregon State Land Board, and they're claiming that the rezoning that the Port of St. Helens, who owns Port Restwood, was had gotten the county to approve, was in fact a violation of the state land use laws, and the appeal was heard, and I guess we're going to hear the results sometime after Thanksgiving. But I was at the hearing a couple weeks ago, and it looked like the panel there was taking it pretty seriously. So if they can't even get the zoning changed, then that will not happen. But one of the things that I found really disconcerting, I've been, of course, spending a lot of time in Tacoma and following the Tacoma LNG project, and there was a supplemental environmental impact statement that was released on October 8th, and it was very disconcerting. It had a lot of misinformation, and not to mention all the typos, including there was one paragraph that was repeated identically. It was just such a sloppy job, but the science was what was really sloppy. Now, there's also a supplemental environmental impact statement that's just been released for Kalama that was for the shoreline permit that was held up until they did a life cycle analysis of all the greenhouse gas emissions. And that one seems to be a carbon copy of the Tacoma one. It's actually produced by the same company. And the only difference was that the end part of the life cycle, instead of it being for LNG that would fuel barges going between Tacoma and Canada and Alaska, this one would be considered the wonderful benefits of helping China reduce its carbon emissions by no longer making methanol from coal, but making it from methanol instead, making plastic from coal as opposed to making it from methanol.
Right. So the route is that you can make methanol from coal or oil derivatives or from gas derivatives. And so the company has alleged that they would be preventing China from using the coal to olefins route. And that's just, there is very little evidence that China already does not want to do that. They're already trying to scale it down. So anyway, I could get buried into the technical details of this, but I've looked.
We got 2 minutes left. So.
Yeah, Stockholm Environment Institute has looked at this to some extent, and the assumptions that are included into that supplemental impact statement they're just wrong, and at minimum, they are only one possible outcome. The more likely outcomes, most economists and most industry observers agree, are that we need to evaluate this one on the merits, and you don't get some extra credit for preventing something that's not likely to happen anyway. And so it's been really frustrating to see those. It's nice that they have to gone back and do more review, but they should actually do the review correctly, because they've absolutely just cherry-picked these bizarre assumptions to advantage the project. Totally inappropriate for these kind of assessments, and we'd like them to go back and have to do it right, or at least present a range, because there are, you know, some of these assumptions are contested, but you don't just get to cherry pick these really, really low numbers that advantage the project.
Well, I mean, one of the ones that was kept being pointed out at the Tacoma hearing was that they're using an analysis of methane emissions over a 100-year period, when methane's intense carbon footprint happens in the first 20 years and then it tapers off. But this project, well, both projects are going to be happening in the next 20 to 50 years. So people are arguing that you need to use a 20-year figure for methane. And if you use that, then of course it's off the charts and there's no comparison.
Yeah, that's right. And even if you do decide to use the 100-year assumption, then you should use the right numbers for it. They actually picked outdated numbers that aren't even accepted by the scientific community anymore, again, in order to advantage the project. And then they took these heroic assumptions about how little methane would leak, which there's barely evidence for it in the literature at all, and most of the literature suggests the leakage rate is much higher. When you actually factor all that stuff in, you can make the project look dramatically worse just by kind of being at the median point of science.
So we've got one more minute, Eric. So what can people do to respond to these two projects in the next few weeks? I know that the comment period for Tacoma ends on Wednesday, and the one for Kalama ends on December 28th.
Yeah, I mean, I encourage folks to get involved. I mean, go contact the PowerPass Fracked Gas Coalition in the Oregon area. Columbia Riverkeeper does fantastic work, heroic work, putting the brakes on these projects. Connect with those groups, comment on those environmental impact statements, and I mean, this really is one of those instances. I mean, make your voice heard gets said too much, but this is an instance where it matters. These are stoppable projects. The review has been terrible. And bring it up with your legislators all the time, constantly. There cannot be any more fossil fuel projects in the Northwest. We have far too many already.
And I'll be doing shows about this continually for the next few weeks, so people can keep in touch, and also have links on the website for how you can get involved. Eric, it's always great to talk to you. So
likewise, Barbara.
And I think next time we talk, we should open the time capsule again.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea.
Okay, maybe we'll talk in January.
Okay,
take care. Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Eric DePlace this morning on Locus Focus. He's the program's director at Sightline Institute, and you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LP FM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we're going to talk about wildfires with Dominic Della Sala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland and an expert on fire ecology. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.
From way up high, abstracted natural bio-relief, witness from the sky, clouds that cast a single shadow, drifting, moving on the ground, creating an illusion as the world goes round. Geometric grace, circle, square, sometimes triangle, ruled with lines in space, waterways and craggy mountains seemingly reveal a plan, just as if somebody drew it with a great big